dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding
in the dark, foggy midnight on Monoculture of Modernity. I'm Robin Upton, and this week on the show we're going to look at alternatives to monocultural capitalist materialism, globalizing, single, one-size-fits-all, one-set-of-multinational-corporations-fits-all approach to organizing society. We're going to look at the fact that historically this is something of a blip, even if it tries to suggest that it is somehow a natural development, somehow a more advanced and more desirable way of living than the polycultural diversity, the thousands of different ways of living that societies used to organize themselves and that many are still seeking to, managing to hold on to. We're going to begin with Professor Jared Diamond speaking about his recent book, The World Until Yesterday, What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. And this recording was made on January the 13th, 2013.
I'm going to talk about growing older in traditional societies. This subject is just one chapter of my latest book, which compares traditional small societies with our big modern societies with respect to many aspects of society, such as growing old, bringing up children, health, dealing with danger, settling disputes, war, religion, and speaking more than one language. This book is my most personal book, my book of, I think, the most practical value to our daily lives, and as a shameless author, I hope it's going to be my best-selling book. It's about what I've learned from spending a lot of my time in traditional tribal societies in New Guinea over the last 50 years. And it's about what friends and other scholars have learned from other tribal societies around the world. All of us here this evening are accustomed to living in big industrial societies, in permanent housing, with central governments to make decisions, with writing and books and the internet, where most people live past age 60, where we regularly encounter strangers, just as I'm encountering you this evening, and where most of us eat food grown by older people. We forget that every one of those things arose very recently in human history. Humans have constituted a separate line of biological evolution for about 6 million years, but all of the things that I just mentioned didn't exist anywhere in the world 11,000 years ago. They arose only within the last 11,000 years, and some of them, such as the internet and the phenomenon of most people living past age 60, arose only within the last century or two. That is, the ancestors of all of us here were living under traditional tribal conditions until virtually yesterday, measured on that 6 million year timescale of human evolution. Until Europeans started to expand around the world 500 years ago, tribal societies still occupied large parts of all of the continents. But tribal societies have recently been coming under the control of modern societies with state governments, to the point where today the last tribal societies not yet under state control are confined to just small areas of New Guinea and the Amazon basin. Those tribal societies, which constituted all human societies for most of human history, are far more diverse than are our modern big societies. All big societies that have governments and where most people are strangers to each other are similar to each other and different from tribal societies in many basic ways, regardless of whether our big societies are American, German, Chinese, Israeli, or whatever. Tribes constitute thousands of natural experiments in how to run a human society. They constitute experiments from which we ourselves may be able to learn. For example, today, if you think that modern American children enjoy too much freedom, or else if you think that modern American children aren't given enough freedom, you cannot perform the decisive experiment of designating 17 American states where kids have to remain strictly subservient to their parents and grandparents, 17 other states where babies will be given the freedom to make their decisions and to play with sharp knives from the age of 2 onwards, and 16 other states where children continue to be treated as they're treated today. If we could only carry out that controlled experiment, we could come back in 40 years, compare the children from all those states, and quickly settle the question whether it's better to raise kids with more freedom, less freedom, or the same freedom that they enjoy today. Unfortunately, it's impossible to carry out that decisive experiment in the U.S., but there are thousands of traditional societies in which children already did grow up with either much more freedom or much less freedom than in the modern U.S. By examining what actually does or did happen in traditional societies that are much more varied than modern American society, we may be able to learn things of practical value to us in deciding how to raise our kids, how to treat our older people, how to remain healthy, and other things that we care a lot about. Tribal societies shouldn't be scorned as primitive and miserable, but also they shouldn't be idealized as happy and peaceful. When we learn of tribal practices, some of them will horrify us, but there are other tribal practices which, when we hear about them, we may admire and envy them and wonder whether we could adopt those practices ourselves. To get some perspective on how we treat elderly people in Western modern societies, let me tell you the opinion of a friend of mine from the Fiji Islands in the Pacific who had visited the United States. There were some things that my friend admired about the U.S., other things that he disliked about the U.S., but what he most loathed about the U.S. was our treatment of older people. He almost shouted at me indignantly, "You Americans throw away your older people." Those were his words. By that, he meant that most old people in the U.S. end up living separately from their children and separately from most of their friends of their earlier years, and often live in separate retirement homes for the elderly. In Fiji and other traditional societies, older people instead live out their lives among their children, their other relatives, and their lifelong friends. Nevertheless, the treatment of the elderly varies enormously among traditional societies, from much worse to much better than in our modern societies. At the worst extreme, many traditional societies get rid of their elderly in one of five increasingly direct ways. The most indirect method to get rid of the elderly is just to neglect them and not to feed them or clean them until they die. The second method is to abandon them when the group moves on. The third method is to encourage older people to commit suicide. A fourth, more direct method is to kill older people with their own cooperation. For example, among the Kaolong people of Papua New Guinea, a widow whose husband has just died asks her brothers or sons to come strangle her. The fifth and most direct method to get rid of the elderly is to kill them without their consent or cooperation. In what tribal societies do children abandon or kill their parents? It happens mainly under two conditions. One is in nomadic hunter-gatherer societies that often shift camp and that are physically incapable of transporting old people who can't walk when the able-bodied younger people already have to carry their young children and their physical possessions. The other condition for getting rid of older people is in societies living in marginal or fluctuating environments, such as the Arctic or shortages, and occasionally there just isn't enough food to keep everyone alive. Whatever food is available has to be reserved for able-bodied people still capable of contributing to the tribe's survival and for the children who will grow up to be the tribe's future adults. Can you still hear okay?
Yes.
Okay, good. To us modern Americans, it sounds horrible to think of abandoning or killing your own sick spouse or your own elderly parent. But what else could those societies do? They face a cruel choice. Their old people had to do it with their own parents, and the old people know what now is going to happen to them. For any of you who are nevertheless still inclined to blame those tribal societies for abandoning or killing the elderly. Let me quote the words of Winston Churchill about the behavior of the Japanese Admiral Kurita at the Battle of Leyte Gulf in October 1944, when Admiral Kurita had to choose between two equally horrible options. Winston Churchill said of Kurita, "Those of you who have endured a similar ordeal may judge him. In fact, many of you, many of us here, have already faced or will face an ordeal similar to the ordeal faced by those nomadic or Arctic or desert tribal societies when you are the physician or the relative responsible for the medical care of an old person, and when you are the one who has to decide whether and when to halt further medical interventions. At the opposite extreme in the treatment of the elderly, the happy extreme, are the New Guinea farming societies where I've been doing my field work for the past 50 years, and the village society of my Fijian friend and many other sedentary traditional societies around the world. In those societies, older people are cared for, they are fed, they remain valuable, and they continue to live in the same hut or else in a nearby hut near their children, their relatives, and their lifelong friends. In traditional New Guinea societies where there aren't dentists and where older people gradually lose their teeth and can no longer chew their own food, their adult children chew the food until it's soft, spit the food into a cup, and give that soft, pre-chewed food to the toothless old person to eat. I don't know of any modern Western society in which such devoted care of old parents is routine. There are two main sets of reasons for this variation among societies in their treatment of old people. The variation depends especially on the usefulness of old people and on the society's values. First, as regards usefulness, older people continue to perform useful services in traditional societies and also in our modern societies. One use of older people in traditional societies is that often they're still effective at producing food. For example, among the Hadza hunter-gatherers of Tanzania, grandmothers are the most productive women at finding and digging up wild edible roots because grandmothers have much more experience than younger women at finding the roots, and they often still have enough strength to dig them up. Hence, measurements show that the growth rate of a Hadza grandchild increases with the amount of time that the grandmother of the kid spends foraging to get food for the kid. While older Hadza hunter-gatherer men may no longer have the strength needed to spear a lion, the men may still be useful in their old age at following animal tracks and at capturing slow or small prey. The lifetime experience of older men means that they know much more than the younger men about the habits of each species of prey animal and about how best to hunt that animal. That value of the experience of older people in traditional societies has also been confirmed for modern farming societies. Among 19th century Canadian farmers and 19th century Finnish farmers, each decade that a grandmother survived past age 50 was correlated with two extra grandchildren of that grandmother eventually surviving because of the grandmother's contribution to resources while still alive. Another traditional usefulness of older people consists of babysitting their grandchildren, thereby freeing up their own adult children, the parents of those grandchildren, for hunting and gathering food for the grandchildren. Still another traditional value of older people is in making tools, weapons, baskets, pots, and textiles. In fact, older people are usually the people who are best at those things. Older people usually are the leaders of traditional societies, people most knowledgeable about medicine, religion, politics, songs, and dances. That's the origin of our expression, tribal elders. To some extent, that's still true today. The average age of American presidents, on assuming the presidency, is 54 years old. Finally, older people in traditional societies have one more huge significance that would never occur to us in our modern literate societies, where our sources of information are books and the internet. In contrast, in traditional societies without writing, older people are the repositories of information. Their knowledge spells the difference between survival and death for the whole society in a time of crisis caused by rare events of which only the oldest people alive have had experience. For example, in 1976, I visited a remote Polynesian island in the Pacific Ocean called Rennell Island in order to do an environmental impact study for a proposed mining project. As part of my study, I asked Rennell Islanders to tell me the name of each species of forest tree in their Polynesian language and to tell me for each tree species whether its fruit or seed was edible. The islanders began to answer me. This tree's fruit is eaten by people. That tree's fruit is eaten by bats, but not by people. This tree's fruit is eaten by birds, not bats or people. But that fruit isn't edible to people or to any animal, and so on. Then the islanders came to a tree of which they said, people eat after hungi kenge. I didn't know what a hungi kenge is, but I let the islanders keep talking about more fruit eaten by people or by birds or by bats, and then they came to another fruit, just eaten by people after hungi kenge, and then several more fruits eaten only after hungi kenge. I was now really curious, and so I asked them, what is a hungi kenge, and why are there some fruits that you eat only after hungi kenge? To answer me, the islanders took me to a hut, inside of which and back was sitting a woman around 80 years old who was now virtually blind and unable to walk. The islanders explained to me that when that woman, that old woman, was only a teenager, Rennell Island had been hit by an enormous cyclone, which they called the Hungi Kenge, and which destroyed all the gardens and much of the forest on Rennell Island. That left people at risk of starving, and so they survived by eating certain species of wild fruits that they normally wouldn't eat, but that old people alive at the time of the Hungi Kenge remembered had been eaten at the time of a previous cyclone. From historical records of Pacific Island cyclones, I calculated that the Hungi Kenge had hit Rennell Island around the year 1910, when the old woman the people were showing me was just a teenager. She was the oldest person still alive on Rennell Island at the time of my visit. If another big cyclone should hit Rennell Island now and again destroy the gardens and much of the forest, the only thing that would save the population of Rennell Island from starving to death would be the memories of that one old woman, the sole person alive who remembered what fruits that were normally considered inedible were safe to eat when nothing else was available. Her knowledge was what would keep her fellow islanders alive until their gardens began producing again. In the U.S., though, we don't rely on oral memory. We instead look up the answers to questions in a book or we Google it. More than any incident in all my years working on Pacific Islands, that story of that old, blind, and lame woman in the hut on Rennell Island made me appreciate the overwhelming importance of the knowledge of older people throughout human history. Before there was writing, in non-literate traditional societies, where the knowledge of older people spells the difference between life and death for their entire society. Those, then, are the ways in which older people are useful in traditional societies. Their usefulness varies among traditional societies and contributes to variation in the society's treatment of the elderly. The other set of reasons for variation in treatment of the elderly is the society's cultural values, which vary somewhat independently of the usefulness of the elderly. For example, among large societies that have had centralized governments for thousands of years, there is particular emphasis on respect for the elderly in East Asia, associated with the philosophy of Confucius and with his doctrine of filial piety. Filial piety means obedience, respect, and support for elderly parents. Cultural values that emphasize respect for older people, such as filial piety, contrast with the low status of the elderly in the United States. Older Americans are at a disadvantage in getting jobs. For example, a sociologist at Boston University carried out the experiment of submitting dozens of job applications in response to ads by prospective employers. All of the applications gave fictitious names of women and all of the applications were identical, except that half of the applications gave the woman applicants ages 25 to 40, while the other half of the applications gave her ages 45 to 60. The result of the experiment was that employers were twice as likely to call a woman age 25 to 40 for a job interview as a woman age 45 to 60. Another example of the low status of the elderly in the U.S. is an explicit policy in our hospitals called age-based allocation of healthcare resources. Listen to those words. Age-based allocation of healthcare resources. That expression is a cruel euphemism. It means that if hospital resources are limited, for example, if a surgeon has time to operate on only a certain number of patients, American hospitals have an explicit policy of giving preference to younger patients over older patients on the grounds that younger patients are more valuable to society, supposedly, because they have more years of life ahead of them, even though the younger patients have fewer years of valuable life experience behind them. There are several reasons for this low status of the elderly in the United States. The high status of the elderly in East Asia is based on the Asian emphasis on filial piety. The low status of elderly Americans arises from several American values that replace filial piety. One is our Protestant work ethic, which places high value on work so that older people who are no longer working aren't respected. Another reason is our American emphasis on the virtues of self-reliance and independence, so that we instinctively scorn older people who are no longer self-reliant and independent. Still, a third reason is our American cult of youth. That cult of youth shows up in our advertisements. Ads for Coca-Cola and beer, just picture them. They always depict smiling young people, even though old people as well as young people buy and drink Coca-Cola and beer. Just ask yourself, what's the last time you saw a Coke or beer ad depicting smiling people 75 or 80 years old? Never. Instead, the only American ads featuring white-haired old people are ads for retirement homes, ads for pension planning, and ads for adult diapers. Well, what has changed in the status of the elderly today compared to their status in traditional societies? There have been a few changes for the better and more changes for the worse. Big changes for the better include the facts that today we enjoy much longer lives, much better health in our old age, and much better recreational opportunities. Also, our older people rarely have had to experience grief from the death of their own child. Whereas in traditional societies, parents routinely have to grieve over the deaths of many or most of their children. Another change for the better in the lives of older people is that we now have specialized retirement facilities and programs to take care of older people. Changes for the worse begin with the cruel reality that we now have far more old people and fewer young people than at any time in the past. That means that all those old people are more of a burden on the few young people, and that each old person has less individual value. On Rennell Island, when I visited there in 1976, there was only that one old woman still alive who remembered how to survive after the Hungi Kengi of 1910. If there had been hundreds of survivors of the 1910 Hungi Kengi still alive in 1976, any single one of those hundreds of survivors would not have been as individually valuable. Another big change for the worse in the status of the elderly is the breaking of social ties with age, because older people, their children and their friends, all move and scatter independently of each other many times during their lives. The average American moves every 5 years. And so our older people are very likely to end up living distant from their children and living distant from the friends of their youth. Yet another change for the worse in the status of the elderly is formal retirement from the workforce, carrying with it a loss of work friendships and a loss of the self-esteem associated with work. Perhaps the biggest of all the changes for the worse in the status of our elderly is that they are objectively less useful than in traditional societies. Widespread literacy means that they are no longer useful as the repositories of knowledge. When we want some information, we look it up in a book or we Google it instead of finding some old person to ask. State-mandated systems of formal education mean that children are taught at particular hours on particular days by particularly young, full-time professional teachers, rather than being taught by all of the older adults as part of everyday life. Finally, the slow pace of technological change in traditional societies means that what someone learns there as a child is still useful when that person is old. But the rapid pace of technological change today means that what we learn as children is no longer useful 60 years later. And we older people aren't fluent in the technologies essential to surviving in modern society. For example, as a 15-year-old high school student, I was considered outstandingly good at multiplying two-digit numbers because I had memorized the multiplication tables, and I know how to use logarithms, and I'm quick at manipulating a slide rule. Today, though, skill at multiplication tables and logs and slide rules is utterly useless because today any idiot can multiply eight-digit numbers accurately and instantly with a pocket calculator. Conversely, I, at age 75, am incompetent at skills essential for everyday life. My family's first television set that we acquired in 1948 had only three knobs that I quickly mastered. There was an on-off switch, there was a volume knob, and there was a channel selector knob. Today, just to watch a television program on the television set in my own living room, I have to operate a 41-button TV remote that I still find utterly confusing, although my children have explained it to me. To watch television, I have to telephone my 25-year-old sons and ask them to talk me through it while I try to push those wretched 41 buttons. What can we do to improve the lives of the elderly in the U.S. and to make better use of their value? That's a huge problem. In my remaining few minutes today, I can offer just a few suggestions. One value of older people is that they are increasingly useful for offering high-quality child care if they choose to do it. As more and more younger women enter the workforce and as fewer young parents stay home as full-time caretakers of their children, compared to the usual alternatives of paid babysitters and daycare centers, grandparents offer superior, motivated, experienced child care. They've already gained experience from raising their own kids. Usually, they love their grandchildren, and they're eager to be permitted to spend time with their grandchildren. Unlike other caregivers, grandparents don't quit their babysitting job because they found another job with higher pay and more Social Security and medical benefits. But there's also a downside to grandparents as babysitters. With the increasing age at which couples are having babies today, the couple's parents often don't become grandparents until they're in their 70s and 80s, when they may no longer have the necessary physical stamina to babysit their grandchildren. A second value of older people today is paradoxically related to their loss of value as a result of changing world conditions and technology. At the same time, older people have gained in value today precisely because of their unique experience of former conditions that have now become rare because of rapid change, but that could come back. For example, only people now in their 70s or older today can remember the experience of living through a Great Depression, the experience of living through a world war, the experience of living through food and gas rationing, and the experience of debating whether or not dropping atomic bombs would be more horrible than the likely consequences of not dropping atomic bombs. Most of our current voters and leaders and politicians have no personal experience of any of those things, but millions of older Americans do. Unfortunately, all of those terrible situations could come back. Even if they don't come back, we have to be able to plan for them on the basis of the experience of what they were like. Older people, older politicians and voters, have that experience. Younger people, younger politicians and voters don't have that experience. The remaining value of older people that I'll mention involves recognizing that while there are many things that older people can no longer do, there are other things that they can do much better than younger people. A challenge for our society is to make use of those things that older people are better at doing. Some abilities, of course, decrease with age. They include abilities at tasks requiring physical strength and stamina, ambition, and the power of novel reasoning in a narrowly circumscribed situation, such as figuring out the structure of DNA best left to scientists under the age of 30. Conversely, valuable attributes that increase with age include experience, understanding of people and human relationships, ability to help other people without your own ego getting in the way of your advice, and interdisciplinary thinking about large databases, such as biogeography and comparative history, best left to scholars over the age of 60, or best of all, over the age of 75. Hence, older people are better than younger people at supervising, administering, advising, strategizing, teaching, and synthesizing. I've seen these values of older people with so many of my friends in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, friends who are still active into their 90s as farmers, lawyers, and surgeons. In short, many traditional societies make better use of their elderly and give their elderly more satisfying lives than we do in modern big societies. Paradoxically, nowadays, when we have more elderly people than ever before, living healthier lives and with better medical care than ever before, old age is in many respects more miserable than ever before. The lives of the elderly are widely considered as constituting a disaster area of modern American society. We can surely do better by learning from the lives of the elderly in traditional societies. But what's true of the lives of the elderly in traditional societies is true of many other features of traditional societies as well. Of course, I'm not advocating that we all give up agriculture and metal tools, return to hunting and gathering, live in small tribes, and resume making tribal war against neighboring tribes. There are many obvious respects in which our lives today are, of course, far happier than those of small traditional societies. To mention just a few examples, our lives are longer, materially much richer, and less plagued by violence than are the lives of people in traditional societies. But there are also things to be admired about people in traditional societies and perhaps to be learned from them. Their lives in traditional societies are usually socially much richer than our lives, although materially poorer. Their children in traditional societies are often or usually more self-confident, more independent, more socially skilled, and more precocious than are the lives of our children. They in traditional societies essentially never die of diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, and the other non-communicable diseases that would be the causes of death of most of us here in this room today. And that's not just because they in traditional societies don't live long enough to get diabetes and those other diseases. Even when you make comparisons at the same age, people living traditional lifestyles are far less likely to get diabetes and heart disease and those other non-communicable diseases than are Americans of the same age. Features of the modern lifestyle predispose us to those diseases, while features of the traditional lifestyle protect us against those diseases. Other chapters of my book deal with other aspects of society besides old age. I have a chapter on dispute resolution, which in traditional societies aims at emotional closure, reconciliation between the parties involved in a dispute. Whereas any of you who've been involved in a civil or criminal law case in the United States, any of you who've been involved in or know a divorcing couple, or a brother or sister, parents and children, who've been involved in an inheritance dispute, you know that the last thing that the American court system cares about is emotional reconciliation. Instead, the government cares about right and wrong. And people end up miserable as a result, often. Warfare, another two chapters in my book, is chronic in traditional societies and involves killing not just young soldier-age men, but women and children, and there are reasons for that. Child-rearing is quite different in traditional societies, and that provides some big surprises that contribute to the fact that children in traditional societies are more independent, self-assured, capable of making their own decisions, socially precocious. Children and babies in traditional societies are carried vertically, uprights facing forwards, not horizontally as in a baby carriage or vertically facing backwards, and that affects development of neuromotor skills. In traditional societies, parents respond quickly, within 10 seconds, preferably within 3 seconds, to an infant crying. There's none of this nonsense about letting a baby cry itself out. And in traditional societies, there were lots of alternative parent models. Every adult in the village or in the tribe is a parent model, and so that means more social role models for a child to learn from than just its parents. Dangers play out differently in traditional societies than in our society. People in traditional societies without 911 and police and doctors are much more attentive than are we to the risks of events which each time they carry a low risk of getting hurt, but you're going to repeat that event many times in your lifetime. People in traditional societies judge dangers realistically. So, for example, I've learned today the most dangerous thing that I did was to take a shower. You may say, what's so dangerous about that? My chances of slipping in the shower are less than 1 in 1,000. Well, just read the obituary column of the newspaper. You'll see that a common cause of death or crippling for older people is slipping in the shower or on the sidewalk or on a stepladder. And if your chances of getting hurt slipping in the shower are only 1 in 1,000, you think that's good, forget it. I intend to take a shower every day for the next 15 or so years of my life. That means 5,475 showers. And if my risk of slipping is 1 in 1,000, I'm going to get killed 5 times before I live out my quota of showers in my next 15 years. Religion plays different functions in traditional societies and modern societies. And that lets one imagine what is going to be the future of religion in the next century. Multilingualism, which in the United States is debated and often feared, multilingualism is routine in traditional societies. And one surprising discovery of the last 5 years is that the best protection that we now know of against the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease is not bridge or Sudoku or any medicine, none of which helps. The best protection is being bilingual. Being bilingual gives you 5 years protection against symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And we don't know yet whether being multilingual gives you 5 years protection multiplied times the number of your extra languages. Those are just some examples, then, of what we can learn from traditional societies. I hope that you find it as fascinating to read in my book about traditional societies as I found it to live in them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Diamond. At this point, we will take questions.
Your book is about what we can learn from traditional societies, and it seems like you're talking about a lot of different activities, some of which are beneficial to learn from them, some of which aren't. And I was just wondering if you had like a rule or something for deciding which things we should imitate and which things we should leave. Is that like a...
Fair enough. Yeah, it is true that I'm not saying that we should imitate everything in traditional societies, nor am I saying that we should despise everything in traditional societies. Some of the things that we should not imitate are obvious. We should not imitate strangling our parent. We should not imitate starving to death. We should not imitate killing a baby if the baby is born weak. Things that we should imitate are anything that is likely to result in children being more self-confident and more socially skilled. We should certainly imitate anything that results in our never getting diabetes, heart disease, or stroke. We should imitate anything that makes us attentive to the realistic dangers, rather than obsessing about terrorists and plane crashes that are going to kill very few people compared to showers. But you're correct that there's a middle ground where it's not so clear what to imitate. For example, it's the case that in traditional societies, people never, never, never spank their children. And yet there is a debate in American society and European society whether or not you should spank your kids. In Sweden, it's a criminal act to spank your children. So that just illustrates that there are things where we have to figure out whether it makes sense or whether, for example, you're going to take your infant into bed with you. It's debated. Many pediatricians advise against it. And yet every baby in human history slept in bed with its parents until the last 5 or 10,000 years. So that's a long-winded way of saying some things are obviously good, some things are obviously bad, some things we have to figure out.
An interesting question about spanking there. an interesting cultural difference. You may recall from Lord Lakoff's characterization of the strict father parenting model, the duty of the righteous father to painfully imprint certain patterns of behavior on his children, like obedience to father's rules, by physical punishment from an early age. That prompted me to include the following piece. This is the soundtrack of a video called The Facts About Spanking by Stephen Molyneux. I think he's a radio presenter. And the video itself is available from our webpage at unwelcomeguest.net/648.
Hi everybody, it's Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio. Let's start with a definition. We're not talking about beating children black and blue. We're not talking about extreme child abuse. We're talking about spanking, which in most of the studies cited here is defined as striking a child with an open hand on the buttocks or extremities with the intention of modifying behavior without causing physical injury. How prevalent is it? Very prevalent. Most of these statistics are to do with the US and the UK. Spanking remains one of the most common strategies to reduce undesired behaviors. Over 90% of American families report having used spanking as a means of discipline at some time. And this continues throughout the childhood of the offspring. Spanking of young children is highly correlated with continued spanking of school-age and adolescent children. More than half of 13 and 14-year-olds are still being hit an average of 8 times per year. Is it widespread? Certainly. Almost 70% of American parents think spanking is not only good, but essential to child rearing. In other words, it would probably be considered abusive to not spank. 90% of parents spank their toddlers at least 3 times a week. 2/3 spank them once a day. 1 in 4 parents begins to spank when their child is 6 months old, really an infant. 50% when their child is 12 months old. This really is too early for children to understand cause and effect and predict consequences to behavior. 52% of 13 and 14-year-olds get spanked, as do 20% of high school seniors. What is the age breakdown? 62% of parents hit their 1-year-old child, even more hit their 4-year-old child, and 7% of these 4-year-olds are being hit at least once a day. By the age of 7, at least 8% are being hit once a day, and a further 33% not less than once a week. 22% of 7-year-olds receive corporal punishment with an implement, some external thing, a belt or a wooden spoon or something like that. 53% have been threatened with an implement. 3/4 of 7-year-olds are either hit or threatened with implements, 91% of boys and 62% of girls. By the age of 11, 18% or 22% of boys are being hit once or more a week, and 15% of boys are being punished with an implement. What triggers it? What causes spanking? Parents are more likely to spank when they are angry or irritable, depressed, fatigued, and stressed. In 44% of those surveyed, corporal punishment was used about 50% of the time because the parent had, quote, lost it. Approximately 85% of parents expressed moderate to high anger, remorse, and agitation while punishing their children. These findings do challenge the notion that parents can or do spank in a calm, planned manner. What are the effects on parents? Although 93% of parents justify spanking, 85% say that they would rather not if they had an acceptable alternative that they could believe in. Well, such alternatives do exist. Strongly urge you to look into them. One study found that 54% of mothers said that spanking was the wrong thing to have done in at least half of the times they used it. That's pretty bad. Spanking is a very aggressive action towards a child, and if you're doing it wrong half the time, you probably shouldn't be doing it at all. What are the effects on children? There is a 93% agreement in scientific studies that spanking is harmful to children. Spanking leads to more antisocial behavior in childhood and increased aggression, increased spousal abuse, and increased child abuse in adulthood. And to be clear here,
I'm not saying everybody who spanks becomes a spousal abuser, but it is strongly correlated that it leads to an increased risk. Now, this 93% agreement has been called an almost unheard of consensus in parenting studies, which are full of contradictory results, but these are very consistent. Defiance. A study shows that disciplining children by spanking puts youngsters at risk for becoming aggressive, antisocial, and chronically defiant, which is why the spanking continues for so many children through their teenage years. Dr. Elizabeth Gershoff has analyzed 88 studies over 62 years to determine the effects of spanking on 11 child behaviors. Apart from immediate compliance, the research showed that spanking had negative effects on other behaviors, substance abuse, and mental health. Children who are spanked and slapped are twice as likely to develop alcohol addiction and other drug abuse problems. A study at McMaster University in Canada found that spanking and slapping children is linked to increased rates of anxiety disorders, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, antisocial behavior, and, to some extent, depression. Spanking by parents can significantly damage a child's mental abilities and results in a lower IQ later in life, suggests a study by researchers at the University of New Hampshire. The research team also looked at corporal punishment practices in 32 countries and found a lower average IQ in nations in which spanking was more prevalent. And imagine if there was some food that was costing your child up to 5 points of his or her IQ capacity or potential. What an outcry there would be. Kids who were physically punished had up to a 5-point lower IQ score than kids who weren't. And the more the children were spanked, the lower their IQs. It is dose dependent. Mental abilities. A study shows that corporal punishment slows the development of mental ability, particularly in younger children aged 2 to 6. Corporal punishment was defined for the study as hitting a child, usually on the buttocks, at least 3 times a week. 93% of mothers hit their 2 to 4-year-olds an average of 3.6 times a week, or 187 times a year. 12.8% hit their children at least 7 times a week. And this is also dose-dependent. The more children were spanked, the more they fell behind in cognitive development. Let's look at some of the data. The higher the percentage of parents in a nation who used corporal punishment with teenagers, the lower the national average IQ. This holds back an entire culture from advancing intellectually. More spanking results in a greater probability of post-traumatic stress symptoms. A lot of corporal punishment more than doubles the percent of people with high PTS symptoms. It adds to the cycle of abuse. Parents who experience frequent corporal punishment as children perceived it as acceptable and frequently spanked their own children. Changing your parenting is one of the most difficult things. Changing from how you were parented to how you are parenting is one of the most difficult and essential things, I would argue, in the world. So people who experience frequent corporal punishment as children, their children in turn advocated spanking as a disciplinary method and preferred aggressive conflict resolution strategies with peers and siblings. How does it affect aggression? Frequent use of corporal punishment, i.e. mother's use of spanking more than twice in the previous month when the child was 3 years of age, was associated with increased risk for higher levels of child aggression when the child was 5 years old. Aggression against children makes children more aggressive. Even controlling for baseline antisocial behavior, the more 3 to 6-year-old children were hit, the worse their behavior was when assessed 2 years later. Again, this is dose dependent. Physical abuse. University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill researchers concluded that parents who report spanking children with an object and parents who frequently spank children are much more likely to report other harsh punishment acts consistent with physical abuse. Again, to be clear, not saying parents who frequently spank children are automatically child abusers, but what we are saying, or what this data is saying, is that if you frequently spank your children, you are more likely to report other harsh punishments acts consistent with physical abuse. Sexual problems. Children whose parents spank or inflict other corporal punishment on them are more likely to have sexual problems later in life, such as a greater chance of physically or verbally coercing a sexual partner, engaging in risky sexual behavior, engaging in masochistic sex, including sexual arousal by spanking. Social problems. Even minimal amounts of spanking can lead to increased likelihoods of antisocial childhood behaviors, such as cheating, and lying and bullying. Children of parents who use physical punishment or yelling and shouting as punitive discipline are much more likely to engage in aggressive behaviors, fighting, bullying, and being mean to others. Children in punitive environments at age 2 to 3 years of age scored almost 40% higher on a scale of aggressive behavior than children in non-punitive homes. Children 8 to 9 years of age scored 83% higher on a scale of aggressive behavior than children in non-punitive homes. Life problems. A study shows a link between childhood aggression and poor outcomes later in life, such as delinquency, crime, poor school results, and unemployment. It's just a link. It's not 100% causal, but there is a link. There is a risk. If you spank your children, there is a risk of these things occurring. That risk is significant, and you don't know ahead of time whether that risk is going to be realized or not. But, this can change. When punitive parenting changes at age 2 to 3 to non-punitive parenting, non-corporal punishment, non-spanking parenting, children eventually score just as low in aggressive behaviors as those in a non-punitive environment. It can change. You can change it. Anxiety. There appears to be a linear association between the frequency of slapping and spanking in childhood and a lifetime prevalence of anxiety disorder, alcohol abuse, or dependence. Crime. Corporal punishment is associated with increased levels of aggression and is a predictor of delinquency, violence, and crime in later life, and a risk factor for child abuse later in life. It's a predictor. Doesn't mean everyone who is spanked becomes a child abuser or a criminal, but it means that almost everyone who is a child abuser or a criminal was spanked as a child. Spanking is just hitting. Children who are spanked as one-year-olds are more likely to behave aggressively and perform worse on cognitive tests as toddlers than children who are spared the punishment, research from Duke University shows. Elizabeth Gershoff, associate professor in human development and family sciences, said the study adds to a growing body of research showing negative effects of spanking. Almost all the studies point to negative effects of spanking, Gershoff said. It makes kids more aggressive, more likely to be delinquent, and to have mental health problems. Because children tend to mimic parental behaviors, it's possible spanking creates a model for using aggression, Gershoff says. Spanking is just hitting. Less is known why spanking could inhibit cognitive development. One possibility is that parents who spank are less likely to use reasoning with their children, something that's good for development, Gershoff said. Parents really, really, really matter. Surveys of 23,000 parents and children finds that parenting styles had a bigger impact on a child's behavior than any other factor. First place to look if your child is not behaving the right way is in the mirror. You are having the biggest effect on your child's behavior. Children who did not have positive interactions with parents were twice as likely to have persistent behavioral problems as those who had positive interactions. Almost 27% of the children surveyed had a clinically defined behavior or learning problem. Is spanking a strategy? Well, parents who spank are more likely to use other forms of corporal punishment and a greater variety of verbal and other punitive methods. When punishment fails, parents who rely on it tend to increase the intensity of its use rather than to change strategy. So if you spank a kid and he doesn't listen, you tend to spank more. You don't tend to look to other solutions. That's why this escalation is so dangerous. Silence about these issues. A recent survey indicated that almost 60% of pediatricians support the use of corporal punishment, at least in certain situations. An analysis of child development textbooks published from 1980 to 2005 showed an average of only half a page on corporal punishment and none that recommended that parents should never spank. This avoidance is really quite astounding. Why is so little space devoted to corporal punishment, which is experienced by over 90% of preschool children and at least a third of infants, when there is overwhelming evidence of its harmful side effects? It's an important question to ask. Let's look at the meta-evidence. All 20 recent studies associated corporal punishment with an increased probability of mental health problems. 12 out of 13 recent studies found corporal punishment associated with a higher probability of delinquent and antisocial behavior. And 4 out of 5 studies found a relation between childhood corporal punishment and later adult criminal behavior. So, to summarize. Spanking leads to increased child aggression, increased delinquent and antisocial behavior, decreased quality of parent-child relationships, decreased child mental health, increased physical abuse, increased adult aggression, increased adult criminal behavior, decreased adult mental health, and an increased risk of abusing one's own spouse or child in adulthood. Okay, so there are excuses or reasons. People say, I was spanked and I turned out fine. Well, 2/3 of people smoke and don't die from smoking. That doesn't mean that smoking isn't dangerous. The problem is you don't know ahead of time whether smoking is going to kill you or not, which is why it's a wise thing to quit. And you probably did turn out fine. But that doesn't mean you couldn't have turned out better if you weren't spanked, even better. So the statistical example of one is not particularly material to the general trend. You can't take that risk with your children about whether it's going to affect them negatively or not. Spanking, parents say, is necessary for good behavior. But the reality is that children who are not spanked are on average the best behaved and have the lowest rates of psychological problems. This has been called the best-kept secret of American child psychology. Spanking creates and exacerbates the very behaviors that spanking is designed to inhibit. Violence or aggression almost always achieves the opposite of its intended goal. People say, well, you can't reason with a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old, and therefore you have to spank. Well, I hope that now you've seen this evidence, and of course feel free to dig into the sources and to come to your own conclusions. But this is pretty compelling evidence and should give all parents pause about the use of spanking and hitting in discipline. Because if you say, I can hit my 5-year-old because I can't reason with him, then you should at least be open to reason yourself and accept reason and evidence and change your behavior thereby, because you can't really have a higher standard for a 5-year-old than you have for yourself. That would be pretty hypocritical.
I was intrigued by you talking about the freedom that the children have. I was interested in knowing what you have seen through history and today about what's better, either to have more freedom for the kids or less freedom.
That's a really good question to follow up on your question. Because so how much freedom should a baby have? In New Guinea society, when I began working in New Guinea in 1964, I noticed that virtually all New Guinea Highlanders had scars, fire scars in their arms, and I thought they'd gotten burnt lighting fire. But no, most of them got burnt as infants, because in Highland New Guinea, where children are considered independent people capable of making their own decisions, it's also considered the baby playing next to a fire can decide whether it's going to roll into the fire or not. Babies learn from that, but I think few Americans would argue that a baby should have the freedom to roll into a fire. Among many traditional societies, babies are permitted to play with sharp knives. I think most of us, I certainly, my wife and I, did not let our kids play with sharp knives, but there are lots of other things that children are permitted to do in traditional societies, which go entirely against the grain of our micromanaging our own children. So your question fits with the previous question. Some things we certainly should permit our children to do. Other things, although traditional societies do it, we may feel uncomfortable with it.
You've been talking about how traditional societies impact us. What about the other direction? A place like New Guinea, where these people are emerging very badly from their traditional society, the place is corrupt and many people have a very difficult time with this. Can you make any suggestions about how that would work better?
The flip side of the coin about the significance of the traditional societies for us is what's the impact that the modern world is having on traditional societies. And every traditional society that I know of, when it hears about the outside world and what the outside world has, wants to acquire some of that stuff. Traditional people, when they see steel axes, they want steel axes instead of stone axes, because steel axes are sharper and they hold their edge for longer. They want matches rather than fire drills. They want manufactured clothing instead of shivering in the rain. They want umbrellas. They want medicines. They want educational opportunities for their kids.